This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Why read a nearly forgotten 20th century Austrian satirist today? Jonathan Franzen joins us to talk about his new book, The Krauss Project.
He's kind of a cantankerous and irascible, super judgmental, super morally black and white figure who never apologized.
Would the world be better off without people in it? Alan Weisman, author of The World Without Us, will talk about his latest, Countdown.
A half a child less per female on this planet would get us back to 6 billion by the end of this century. And every decade, it would just become a little bit easier to feed everybody.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field, and Greg Coles will update us on bestseller news.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
Jonathan Franzen joins us to talk about his new book, The Krauss Project, Essays by Karl Krauss, which he has translated and annotated. Hi, Jonathan.
Hey, Pamela.
Thanks for joining us. So tell me about how you came to this project. How did you decide? Where did your interest in Karl Krauss begin?
It's a long story. I found myself a German major, for want of anything else to major in, and got very involved with German literature, including around the time I was graduating from college, Karl Krauss, who was very hard and therefore kind of a challenge, and I liked a challenge, and he was very funny, which cannot be said of every German writer, actually a little more true of Austrian writers, but still, it was great to find somebody funny, and he was angry, and of course, you know, I was 22, so I was angry myself, so I got very involved in first reading him and then trying to translate the very essays that are in this book. Soon came to realize why they not only had never been translated, but were considered untranslatable. Krauss really is hard, and he's even harder to translate.
Is this the first time these particular works that you chose have been translated into English?
Yeah. This is all untranslated stuff.
And how much of his work had already been translated? I mean, he was extremely prolific.
Not very much. I think parts of his great long documentary play, The Last Days of Mankind, have been translated, and a lot of his aphorisms. He was a terrific and often hilarious aphorist, and those, if you chew on them for a while, you can crack. And they've been fairly well translated. And there have been a few collections, just little samplers, but most of his work, you know, his life's work was producing this magazine, Die Fackel, translated as The Torch, and he was, after about 10 years, its sole author, and it takes up, I don't know, like 5 feet of shelf space. So that's a lot. And all of it incredibly densely written and meticulously edited. So it's not just throwaway stuff. So he did produce a lot. A lot of what then was collected as essays first appeared in Die Fackel, including these what's in this new book.
I was recently reading The Hair with Amber Eyes, Edmund Duval's book about his family, and he quotes Krauss in there a number of times to the point where you get to, you know, here's another quote by Krauss. But he's known really for his aphorisms, at least here in America, more than anything. But that's not what you chose to look at. How did you decide what you wanted to translate?
When I was in Berlin studying after college, I took a seminar in Krauss and really on his play, The Last Days of Mankind. And for supplementary reading, we were given a couple of essays, which I then proceeded to try to read. Hard as they were not as hard as the play. And because I happened to have Xeroxes in them, when I, one rainy afternoon back in the U.S., decided, hey, I'm going to try to translate this guy, that's what I had. These, and I still have those Xeroxes made in Berlin in 1981 or something. But it turned out that they had not been selected randomly. They're sort of the two main pieces in the book are kind of companion pieces. One is this really hilarious and vicious takedown of Heinrich Heine, who is this very, very major figure in 19th century German letters. And the other is the opposite. It's the celebration of a very funny and brilliant Austrian playwright, Johann Nestroy, who was really held in very low regard at the time. So one of them is a teardown, and one of them is a build-up project. And both of them are concerned with how does the satirist function in society? That was the question we were asking in that particular seminar. As it happened, the Heine essay is considered one of his most brilliant pieces of writing. I didn't know that at the time. And it's something that really absolutely should be available in English.
I imagine that part of what made this then an interesting project for you personally is to return to these essays that you encountered first as a student so many years ago and now rereading them. Did you have a different experience in rereading them now?
It was very strange to come back to the essays because I had felt I was really through with Krauss. And when I was touring for one of my books in Vienna some years ago, I met this young guy, this goofy young guy, Daniel Kalman, who was about to become super famous in Germany, but the book was in fact appearing on Germany's equivalent of the Oprah Book Club the night I met him. And he just wanted to talk about Krauss. He loved Krauss, and he said, "I hear you like Krauss." And somehow or other that got into the press a little bit, and I heard from this Krauss scholar out in Ohio, Paul Reiter, somehow found myself promising to go back to these translations that I'd abandoned and finish them, and he had offered his help annotating them. And some more years went by, and I felt I made this promise, I have to keep it. But I kept putting them off year after year. And finally, the right moment came. I'd been working with HBO for a year trying to turn the corrections into television. And that experience made me just want to plunge into something really hard and different. So I went back. And
that's a good contrast, going from an HBO adaptation to a German translation.
It was like I've been having pie for a year, and now let's have some kale. And sometimes, you know, you really crave the kale, and Krauss was seeming like the kale. Two things happened. One, since I was now working with a couple of people who really knew their stuff, particularly Paul Reiter, who's you know, it's his field, the essays made so much more sense. Stuff that I had no chance of figuring out suddenly popped into focus when I understood what Krauss was talking about, what he was referring to, what he was echoing. And I got back in the spirit. I'd quickly kind of outgrown Krauss because he was a problematic figure in many ways. He was brilliant. He was hilarious. I think he was right about a lot of stuff, but he was also terribly wrong about a lot of stuff.
What was he wrong about?
Well, we have a whole discussion of his use of anti-Semitic tropes in this Heine essay. He's basically taking the right-wing anti-Semites' arguments about how Heine had polluted German literature and reproducing them kind of whole cloth. He's sort of making fun of those arguments, but he's also using them. Another example, he was famously very independent. He didn't take advertisers. He didn't rely on subscribers. He just published his own magazine the way he wanted to. But he could do that because he was independently wealthy. And although he was generous to his poor friends and struggling writers, he also, if anyone disagreed with him, he'd take them to court. He drove people out of town by threatening lawsuits, winning lawsuits that people couldn't afford to pay off. So he was kind of a cantankerous and irascible, super judgmental, super morally black and white figure who never apologized, never admitted that he was wrong. He was wrong about Dreyfus. He never, to the end of his days, admitted that he'd been wrong about the Dreyfus case.
For our listeners who aren't familiar with Krauss, the years that he wrote in...
He was active really the first three decades of the 20th century. He started his magazine in 1899, and he died in 1936 and stopped publishing shortly before then. So he was a key figure in the Viennese scene, which included all the great people, you know, Freud and Mahler and Schnitzler and Musil, all of those people, and did his very finest work anticipating the First World War and relentlessly satirizing the bad rhetoric that was accompanying the war. So he's very much a figure of that particular end of empire time in Vienna's history.
And then, of course, you have to ask about coming up to Nazism and leading up to World War II. He was born Jewish but converted to Catholicism.
Yeah, he sort of tepidly converted to make some sort of point to Catholicism. In spite of his use of these anti-Semitic tropes in his writing, he was one of the first to really take the true measure of Hitler and the Nazis. And he went silent about them, but he was writing all along this really devastating critique of their ideology, which, as Daniel points out, anyone who says, well, you couldn't have known in 1933 everything that the Nazis were going to do, you can't make that argument, because Krauss proved that you could have known exactly what they were going to do, because they were saying what they were going to do.
Right.
And no one was even paying attention. He was paying attention. So he was heroic in that way. But he was also, I didn't want to be that morally black and white person anymore. So I went back with a lot of skepticism and got kind of reinfected by it, because what he was saying about the nexus of media and technology, although it applied pretty well to what was happening with newspapers in his era, seemed kind of uncannily apt when you look at our own era, as if he was righter about now than he was about his own time. It's interesting to go back and see even 100 years ago, someone could see some of this stuff coming.
Right. For those readers or those listeners who are contemplating reading this and they think, well, I don't know Karl Krauss and I don't know Heine and I don't know Nestroy, you know, how is this relevant? How is this not Kale? what would you say?
A couple things. Just first on the footnotes, I knew he's hard and I knew it's asking a lot, even for a very serious reader, to read page after page of Krauss. So I thought all along, we're going to need a whole lot of footnotes, partly to
help. It's leavened with footnotes.
Yeah, really leaven. And a lot of it is kind of harmonizing with his critique of the commercial media tech nexus. And it was fun, and it was interesting to do. And I have kind of strong feelings about social media in particular, Twitter in particular.
We've heard about those.
And about the concentration of wealth in the hands of a few that is happening simultaneously while we are being told that everything is becoming more and more equal and democratic.
Right.
And liberated. Something isn't quite adding up. And that was the kind of disparity between facts on the ground and the rhetoric accompanying those facts that Krauss was all over. So there seemed to be some opportunities to riff, and I didn't hold back in the riffing. But it's funny, you know, we're doing this podcast after the book has come out, and I've done some public events for it. And I have to say, I came away feeling again that I'm glad I did the book, but I'm also glad I don't have to be Krauss 24/7, because you get infected by this view of the world, this really, really judgmental view of the world. It's fun, and there's a lot of truth to it. I mean, there is something wrong with our addictive relationship to these technologies, and there is something flattening, and there is something actually impoverishing, literally, for freelance writers about the tech developments in the
right.
last 15, 20 years. But what I wanted to do with the book really was finally to humanize it. And it's hard, actually, when you get pulled into this discussion, oh, you hate Twitter. Tell us why you hate Twitter. Well, Twitter hates you, too. You get into this nya-nya-nya situation. And in the book, on the page, I was trying to actually find some humane middle.
Right.
The strange, dark truth about Krauss was that his work really was very blog-like. He would take a line and then he would do essentially a blog entry on it, and then he would take another line from the press and he would do another blog entry on it. And he loved that kind of fighting.
And he turned out his own magazine, like 922 issues of this little blog-like magazine.
Right, and is very susceptible to the criticism that, of course, he could afford to do that because he was independently wealthy, but people who weren't couldn't do that, and now everyone can. Two cheers for that. Two cheers for that aspect of the internet. But that kind of disputatious quality, that sense of spending all your time reading stuff you kind of hate in order to be brilliantly entertaining about how much you hate it, that was Krauss. That was the internet. So even as he was criticizing it, he was kind of embodying it, too.
Well, the book is The Krauss Project, Essays by Karl Krauss, and it has been translated and annotated by Jonathan Franzen. Jonathan, thank you so much.
Great pleasure. Thanks a lot.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is Wilson, written by Pulitzer Prize recipient and award-winning biographer A. Scott Berg. That's Wilson, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman joins us with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Pamela.
Big news today.
Very big news. As you know, it is award season in publishing, and the biggest one came this week, the Nobel Prize in Literature. And in a decision that made a lot of people in Canada and the United States very happy, Alice Munro is the winner of the Nobel this year, and she is, of course, the famed writer who writes short stories. And, you know, she has a lot of fans in the States.
Now, this is unusual for a number of reasons. First of all, short stories.
Yeah, very unusual. I mean, I can't think of another winner of the Literature Nobel who is primarily a short story writer. I mean, certainly there have been many winners who have written short stories, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Octavio Paz, there are many, but also this is a very interesting prize because it's usually a novelist, it's usually a poet. It's very rarely someone who focuses on the short story. So there are a lot of people who see this prize as a celebration of that form beyond a celebration of the work of a very masterly writer.
And people also are saying that it's a departure from recent years, which have at least seemed to be more overtly political, and that this feels like a real literary award.
Definitely. I think that over the last few years, and beyond the last few years, actually, it feels like the Swedish Academy has chosen the winners of the Nobel for reasons that were influenced by politics in the very least, and that goes back at least 5 years. So this year was interesting in that there were certainly no political reasons for a Canadian writer like Alice Munro to have been chosen. So I think that it has been viewed so far as a very purely literary choice, a choice that is certainly unusual in that she's a Canadian writer. There's been some debate this morning over whether she is the first Canadian writer to win the Nobel Prize, but we have to remember that Saul Bellow, who has won the prize, was born in Montreal, even though he is identified with Chicago and lived there for a long time and essentially renounced Canada. He's still technically Canadian.
So other than that sort of quasi-Canadian, is she the first?
Oh, I think so. I mean, we're still kind of figuring out all the things that are firsts about this prize, but she's the 13th woman to win the award. And I think almost all of those women have won the prize since 1991. So this is a fairly modern phenomenon that the prize has been opened up to women.
And While in America, Alice Munro is widely embraced and often associated here with the New Yorker, it's been a long time since an American has won.
It's been a very long time. We have a very long losing streak for American writers. The last American who won the Nobel Prize in Literature was Toni Morrison, and that was in 1993. Philip Roth and Joyce Carol Oates were two Americans who are always cited as possibilities for the prize. We'll just have to wait a little bit longer, and maybe even longer now that a winner from North America has gotten the prize. So that is, anyone waiting for an American to win has to wait a little bit longer.
Now, going back to the placing of bets, we here in the States talk about Philip Roth and Joyce Carol Oates, but they weren't among the top contenders, at least according to Ladbrokes and the sort of the UK press.
That's right. The UK press always has a field day trying to figure out who's going to win. Unlike a lot of other prizes like the National Book Awards and the Man Booker Prize, there is no publicly released shortlist for the Nobel. So it's really a wide open field every year. Yet, in The Guardian and The Independent and The Telegraph, in all those British papers and in the betting, the bookmaking fields, there are always a lot of guesses, and it seems like the same names seem to pop up every year. This year, the number one choice was Haruki Murakami, who is the Japanese author of, many novels, but he's pretty well known in the United States.
IQ 84 and Norwegian Wood, The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle.
So he was thought to be a very likely winner. Alice Munro was, I believe, in the number two slot. So Ladbrokes will have to try again next year. They had another year of not choosing the correct winner.
All right. Well, it sounds like we're still figuring out exactly what to make of it, but know that we are all very, very happy to hear about Alice Munro. Thank you, Julie.
Thanks so much.
Alan Weisman joins us from Tucson, Arizona, on his book tour for his new book, Countdown. Hi, Alan.
Hi.
So I remember reading your first book, The World Without Us, and thinking as I read along, it's about what would happen to the planet if there were no humans, for those who haven't read it. A really interesting narrative nonfiction thought experiment. And I was thinking, wow, you know, this is great. Like, if we just weren't here, everything would be fine. And in this book, you sort of take up that idea and say, well, obviously, we are still here. So where does this leave us?
The reason I wrote The World Without Us is not because I wanted a world without human beings. I'm a human being. I'm married to one. My friends are human beings. I like our species. But I realized in my research to that book that in order to have a world with us, you know, I was hoping that people would see this beautifully restored nature that would occur if, you know, if our daily pressures were removed from this planet, and then think, wow, is there some way that we can still be part of this picture, only in a more harmonious relationship with nature? But what I found out was that we were increasing by 1 million people every 4.5 days. And a lot of people, when they read the book, because I left that dangling at the end of that book, and just asking the question, should this be on the table? Should we be thinking about this if we want to keep having a civilization on this planet? Many people all over the world wanted to talk about it. You know, that book's out in 34 languages, and I spoke in many places, and I constantly kept coming back to it. But population is such a loaded question. It makes us uncomfortable. You know, it's in our nature to make copies of ourselves like any other organism. The idea of restriction immediately calls to mind the Chinese one-child policy, which most people find just abhorrent. Even the Chinese don't like it that much. I spent a month there for this book. But I decided, you know, a journalist has to look at this thing as objectively as possible and understanding all sides of this issue, the environmental side of the issue, understanding the people who have been traditionally opposed to it for, you know, be fruitful and multiply is something that every nation and every religion begins with because they want to become the mighty dominant force in their region. I had to try to cut through all of that to see, is this something that could be socially acceptable to the great majority of the world's cultures and religions? Is there anything in their history that would embrace, so to speak, the idea of refraining from embracing so much in times of need? And so I went to 21 countries and I found out that, yes, there is plenty of precedent for it. And in fact, the world right now has a lot of momentum towards this.
When you say this, what is it that you're referring to?
The idea that it's healthier for people, for families, and for our entire planet to have fewer children. It turns out that the best contraception of all on this planet is educating females. On the average throughout the world, poor countries, rich countries, all the places I went, if a woman gets through high school, but particularly if she gets into the university, she will defer her childbearing until her education is done. And once it's done, there's an opportunity for her to do something interesting with her life beyond just having children, which is a lovely thing to do. But if you have seven of them, you can't exercise your profession and you can't be earning money for your family, which is important these days. This is an opportunity that we have to make an impact on our environmental impact right now.
And do you have a recommendation in terms of numbers?
You know, there are two numbers issues here. How many would be the right number of people on this planet so we wouldn't tip it over? And also, how much would it cost to do this? I looked at the numbers thing through the lenses of various different experts who've been thinking about this for years. They've been thinking about how much carbon dioxide can we put up into the atmosphere without really destabilizing systems. And then distributing that energy impact among all of us so each of us would have a chance at an acceptable lifestyle, say a European lifestyle as opposed to an energy profligate U.S. lifestyle or a very energy poor South Asian or African lifestyle. And the numbers that they came up with were somewhere between 1.5 to 3 billion, a little less than half of what we are right now. Another way of looking at it, of course, is food production. A lot of people think that the Green Revolution refuted the predictions of Malthus and Paul and Ann Ehrlich that we were all going to collapse into famine. But it turns out that the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, who founded the Green Revolution, in his acceptance speech said that all we've done is buy a generation of time because food production cannot, all it does is save a lot of people's lives so they live to beget more children. And paradoxically, we end up having more hungry people at the end of that. So, you know, the famines in Pakistan and India that were averted mean that now India is going to surpass China in a decade as the most populous country. And Pakistan, as I show in this book, is really waxing out of control. They've got 185 million people in a land the size of Texas.
So you have all these very strong impulses against this. You talked about the religious, you know, impulse, the go forth and multiply, the personal impulse that, you know, people want to have children and carry forth their legacy, or they want a large family, the economic impulse. I mean, when economists talk about the future of America, the future of Western Europe and of Japan especially, they talk about that these are aging populations, that there aren't enough young people, that the governments urge people to women, especially with incentives. In France, for example, with the Famille Nombreuse, to have more children.
Yeah, and all those incentives haven't really worked. I talk about many countries here where the governments are trying to bribe women to have more babies, and educated women aren't having that. They know that they want to be mothers, but they don't want to completely dedicate their lives to raising too many children that are hard to afford. They want to have a balance between their professional life and childbearing. The idea that we would not have enough laborers, And frankly, economists, traditional economists, are a little bit too shrill on this, because they like overpopulation, because that means that the labor force is crowded and therefore it's cheap and it's easier to exploit people. I speak to many economists in this book, including in Japan, who show how a gradual transition towards a steady state economy is both inevitable in this planet, because we can't keep growing forever on a planet that doesn't grow itself, and that we would have plenty of opportunity to readjust ourselves to an economy that wouldn't depend on constant growth. There would be fewer laborers, but demand would start falling as we would be trading more leisure time, you know, fewer hours of working for the frenetic lives that just buy us a couple of consumer toys that we have very little time to really enjoy. It would be a healthier world with fewer of us causing the problems. You know, a lot of people, when Obama was elected, thought he was going to be the next FDR, and they were a little disappointed when things proved more complicated. I never see it analyzed in the news that Obama has three times as many Americans to try to employ and to take care of as FDR did. And I'm hard-pressed to think of a problem on this planet that wouldn't be easier and less complicated if we had fewer people.
So what does this mean in terms of, we talked about the global population, but in terms of the actual birth rate, the replacement rate to maintain the current population is what, is 1.3?
No, replacement rate is really two.
Two
people have two children. It's slightly above that because there's still some infant mortality, though.
Right.
One of the reasons population grew so fast in the 20th century is that we have better medicine.
And 1.3 is what they have in Japan, where it's declining.
And their population is declining, and that's because they cut off their baby boom after World War II. Japan lost the war. Their economy was in tatters. People were starving, and babies were dying of hunger. So in an emergency measure, Japan legalized abortion. You know, this was before birth control pills. And as a result, this much smaller baby boom generation that is replacing the overgrown generation before it, which was the reason why Japan got into World War II in the first place. They invaded Manchuria for more room. You know, suddenly their numbers are going to drop, and they will keep dropping till the middle of this century. And there's a great economist in this book, Akihiko Matsutani, who sees this as an opportunity to bring Japan back to a sane balance with its island and with its lifestyle.
So is that rate that they have right now the global ideal? Or, because we were talking about not maintaining, but actually shrinking the number of people. So we want, do you have a rate that's sort of the ideal, or how many children a family should have?
Well, you know, right now we're headed to nearly 11 billion by the end of the century.
Right.
I don't think we're going to make it. We're at 7.2 billion right now, and we already see our planet bursting at the seams. Our atmosphere is overloaded with our exhaust. It's changing the chemistry of the seas. That's changing the entire ecosystem in ways that we don't even know what's going to happen. And, you know, this is uncharted territory that's going to be very, very difficult to navigate. You know, when you say 1.3, you're really saying that between one and two children for family.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to let people have at least two children, because people just react against the idea of being restricted to one. And two doesn't grow the population anymore. And frankly, if you want to have more children, a big family, one resource that is not running out on this planet is homeless children. There's always opportunity to adopt. So, but if the birth rate stays between two and one, we will gradually, over the next couple of decades, come down to a much more sustainable number. A half a child less per female on this planet would get us back to 6 billion by the end of this century. And every decade, it would just become a little bit easier to feed everybody. I went to the Green Revolution centers, and they're really running out of tricks. You know, as the founder warned, we can't keep doing this forever. In fact, he was on the boards of population groups all his life after the Green Revolution. I mentioned before a figure about money. For just $8.5 billion per year, which is what the United States was spending per month in Iraq and Afghanistan, we could provide universal access to contraception all throughout the world I have several examples in this book of countries that didn't do what China did, made it voluntary, but made it available. And women chose to have a reasonable number of children that they could afford to raise, and their birth rates, in one case, Iran of all places, they brought their birth rate down to replacement rate a year faster than China did. And they did it by making contraception accessible and encouraging women to stay in school. And today, 60% of university students in Iran are female, and that has done it.
I have to ask, of course, do you have children?
No, my wife and I had a daughter who died in the infancy.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And then unfortunately, we had some pregnancies that didn't last, and ultimately, at a certain point, we were just too old. And yes, it's a tragedy in life, and life is never a perfect system. Bad things happen to all of us, and right now, difficult things are happening to us globally.
Right.
But there are things that we can do about it, and I hope that we do.
I mean, I take it down to the personal level because, of course, this is one of those arguments that people agree in the abstract and say, well, yes, of course. And then when it comes to their own family, think, well, but I need, you know, I want to have three children, or I grew up in a family of five, or whatever the personal or religious or familial reason is for having more children, that it's a hard argument to convince people to make such a huge change in their own lives.
That's true, but the norm, you know, the post-war, World War II norm of, you know, 3 to 4 kids in a family in the United States, that isn't happening very much anymore.
Right.
You know, 1950, two-thirds of the planet, people were rural. Now more than half of us live in cities. Out there on the farm, you wanted a lot of kids because they were farmhands. They helped do things. In a city, a child costs money. It doesn't help the family's economy because you have to clothe an educator, and you're living in more crowded conditions. So people are choosing to have just one or two kids much more often. But as I say, you know, you want a large family, there are a lot of children who are waiting to be embraced by you.
So, Alan, thank you so much. The book, again, is Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. Alan Weissman is the author. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Greg Coles joins us with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's on the list this week?
Let's take a look over at the hardcover lists, starting on the fiction side. New at number 3, James Patterson, who we
have met before.
Yeah, literally. he's got a new one called Gone that is part of his Michael Bennett series, which is always co-written with Michael Ledwidge. Then at number 4, Elizabeth Gilbert's first novel in 13 years, her first work of fiction in 13 years. Since well before her Eat, Pray, Love tsunami.
I was going to say juggernaut, coming up with euphemisms.
This novel is called The Signature of All Things. It is about a 19th century botanist, and it makes its debut on the list at number 4. Then at number 9, Iris Johansson concludes a trilogy about her character Eve Duncan with a third book called Silencing Eve. All three of these books have turned up on the hardcover list this year. Then at number 10, Anne Hillerman has a novel called Spider Woman's Daughter.
And she is the daughter of Tony Hillerman.
Yes, she is. And so she's actually continuing her father's characters in this book. Then at number 14, Jeffrey Deaver's The October List is new on the list. And then finally, new on the list this week at number 16, J.R. Ward, the paranormal romance writer, has a book called Possession, which is book 5 of a series.
All right, nonfiction.
Over on the nonfiction side of things, a name that we'll be seeing for a long time to come, Malcolm Gladwell, has a new book out. It makes its debut at number 2 on the list. It's called David and Goliath. And this one looks at how we can turn our disadvantages to our advantages and how the little guy can win.
Now, does he often come in at number 1, or is this unusual that he's in the number 2 slot to open?
He's often at number 1. I don't know if he often debuts at number 1, it's not so unusual in this case that he's not, because number one on the nonfiction
list. He's up against Jesus.
He's up against Jesus. And not only Jesus, but Bill O'Reilly.
Two formidable figures.
Killing Jesus by Bill O'Reilly and Martin Dugard remains at number one this week in its second week on the list. So Malcolm Gladwell will have to settle for number two.
He's the underdog.
Nice one. Then there are three more new books on the hardcover nonfiction list this week. Bill Bryson, who wrote A Short History of Nearly Everything and Home and A Walk in the Woods. And he's
Nearly Everything.
Yeah. He writes these kind of comic histories and personal narratives. He's got a book now looking back at the summer of 1927 in America. It's called One Summer, new at number four. It's a really interesting book. He often just crams his books full of facts, and this one he ties together. He kind of connects the dots of that summer. It's the summer that Charles Lindbergh crossed the Atlantic for the first time.
Right.
It's the summer that Babe Ruth broke the home run record with 60 home runs. It's the summer of the Great Mississippi Flood. He looks at the kind of the seeds of the financial crisis that would bring down the stock market 2 years later. And he just kind of ties it all together to show how this is the summer that really America turned the corner and became a real world power that year.
Interesting.
Then at number eight, Nick Offerman, who plays the character Ron Swanson on the sitcom Parks and Recreation. He has a book out that's part memoir, autobiography, and part advice for living. Nick Offerman has kind of a great wry deadpan. He's far and away the breakaway character on the show Parks and Recreation. I will confess, I'm a huge fan. This book called Paddle Your Own Canoe is kind of his life philosophies. You get to see where he overlaps with the character Ron Swanson and where he doesn't. And it's hard not to read it hearing Ron's voice throughout. And then finally, the last new book on the nonfiction list this week is by Chris Matthews, the political commentator and former speechwriter to not just Jimmy Carter, but also Tip O'Neill. This book is called Tip and the Gipper, and it's looking back at the mostly friendly relationship between the Democratic Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, and the Republican president, Ronald Reagan.
In other words, a long, long time ago.
for what used to be.
All right. Well, thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.